Hello everyone and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly podcast. Here we take a critical look at a number of topical developments which have a leadership and management theme. My name's Nick Scott, an academic and economist working with the Institute, and in this podcast we'll be looking at news items up to the 19th of February 2020. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Nick.
In our first news item, media outfit Fast Company reports how the US division of Body Shop is adopting a radically revised recruitment policy. Described as an open hiring model, where roles are allocated on a first-come, first-served basis, US General Manager Andrea Bleeden says that they are dropping background checks and asking only three simple questions. Are you legally entitled to work? Can you stand up for 8 hours? And can you lift over 50 pounds? That's around 25 kilos. A 2019 trial of 200 applicants who answered yes to these questions resulted in a 20% reduction in staff turnover. So Kate, what can leaders take away from the open hiring model?
What the Body Shop has done here by taking the job back to its absolute basics, what do we really need in order for this job to be completed successfully, has shone a light upon some of the practices that have grown up with very good intentions, such as transparency and standardisation and inclusivity, so people aren't overlooked. But by doing that, we've come up with desirable and essential characteristics, skills, knowledge, qualifications. So we're able to shortlist or we're able to screen. So we're making one system to simplify a process, and in doing so, perhaps lose sight of what the jobs are really about. And if we're all to think about what do we really need to do our jobs well, what do we really need to add value to the organisation, indeed what is the point of us, that gives us a sort of clarity that when we're talking about performance appraisal, or we're talking about replacing people who are leaving or creating new posts, we can ask much simpler questions, possibly with more difficult answers, but will encourage us to broaden what we're looking for. So often with recruitment, we take experience of something as being the most important thing. We've worked in the charity sector, for example, and that's the thing that we want, when actually so many things can be learned quickly. Things that take ages to learn, like managing people well, building relationships, they're transferable, but often they're not very high up the what we're looking for list. So it is a wake-up call for all of us involved in recruitment to think, what do we really want for this job?
Our second news story comes from business intelligence firm Gartner. In their emerging risks report, they assert that executives believe that more than half the time they spend in strategic planning is wasted, with the quality of these plans generally failing to meet expectations. Risk and Audit VP Matt Schinkman explains that strategic assumptions are often sound when they are first formed, but in today's environment, they are more vulnerable to becoming outdated or obsolete due to a rapid increase in the pace of change. Schinkman argues that risk leaders should develop criteria to stress test assumptions and hence root out biases and flaws before they become embedded. So Kate, is he right? How can leaders train themselves to recognise that a particular strategic approach is past its sell-by date?
Ralph Stacey's work, which he began in the 1980s, looking at complexity and the real problem of strategic plans as he saw it, that essentially you're trying to predict an uncertain future. So how can you? His later work looked very much at the association of strategic planning with anxiety, and I think that is so often what happens. We cannot predict the future. We are going to be judged on our performance, our future results. We have to put forward a case that is plausible, is compelling. And in doing so, not only does that quell the anxiety of the people who are creating the plans, but also the people for whom the plans are for. There's nothing as seductive as certainty. We want people to tell us they know what's going on and they know what's going to happen. But if we actually examine that misconception, of course we can't predict the future. Of course our own biases, misunderstandings, lack of an evidence base are going to be part of the strategic plans that we make. But they're not doing the job. They're not delivering the results. They're just saying this would be nice if this happened. And that's what we so often lose sight of. We disproportionately spend time on formulating strategy and perhaps not as much as we should on how we make it happen.
Our next news item reflects on a contentious article by Sarah Kaplan in Fast Company, where she asks why the apparent obvious business case for greater diversity isn't working. Despite strong evidence-based support, the 2020 Global Gender Gap Report by the World Economic Forum shows that with the current rate of progress, Europe won't reach gender parity for 50 years, and it'll take twice as long as this in North America. Kaplan argues that what's required for transformational action is a moral and legal case. The business case, because it's based on an economic logic, can undermine moral arguments and weakens resolve to make anything other than incremental change. So Kate, popular as it may be, has the business case for diversity been a failed strategy?
Aviva Wittenberg Cox presents persuasive and compelling arguments for what she would term gender-balanced organisations. And so many organisations still see diversity initiatives as a nice-to-have, but something you have to do later when you've dealt with the current imperatives. And I think presenting, as Kaplan has done here, as moral or legal or business, is a weakness. Everything contributes. We found with the Equal Pay Act in the UK that that didn't achieve parity in pay, and obviously still hasn't. But it's important that there's a legal recognition of the responsibilities of organisations. Let us have legislation that supports the argument. Let us challenge morally. But to me, I always think the business case is often more compelling. An evidence base is so much more difficult to argue against than a moral position, and much less resistance, of course, to one that requires legislation, subsequent compliance and monitoring. So let us not lose sight of those arguments, but please don't think that they're a substitute for a strong business case.
Our final story this week reflects on a recent article by Deborah Lee Sheraton. On chiefexecutive.net, she argues that the benefits of having a diverse workforce are likely to be lost without balanced conversations. She cites a study by sociologists at the University of Santa Barbara, which explored the link between gender and interruption in both same-sex and mixed-sex groups. The primary finding was that men interrupt women far more than interrupting men, and far more than women interrupt men or women. Interruption can create a sense of dismissal or exclusion, which can undermine respect and self-worth, to the point that people feel less involved and stifle their own contribution. What can leaders do to facilitate better balanced conversations in the workplace?
One only has to look at the work of Deborah Tannen, which came to prominence in the 1990s, to know how differently men and women use conversation. Men often use it in a competitive way to derive status from the exchange, women more likely to use it in a way that is more genuine sharing of information. So the fact that men are less inclined to interrupt other men really is more evidence to Tannen's hypothesis. They will only use conversation or frequently use conversation in order to score points. And maybe with non-interrupters, such as women, it's easier to score those points. The impact that this will have on women who feel put down by the interruptions, feel not listened to, and not want to contribute in the future, that's the serious result. And that's the challenge, not only to men to stop interrupting, if that can be a message, but also to women to think this happens, this isn't anyone's fault, this is about patterns of conversation, so I've got to come back and I too can interrupt if it's appropriate.
Well, thanks very much for that, Kate, and that does conclude this week's episode. So please subscribe to this podcast for further insights into breaking news stories, and listeners can, of course, find further topical content in the News and Views section of the Institute's website on www.instituteLM.com.